Siding Unlimited, named the best window installers, not just here, but in the whole USA. Get the best. Siding Unlimited, 5-time winner as America's best window installer. For windows you call Siding Unlimited, first and directly, SidingUnlimited.com.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios in downtown Milwaukee, it's Wisconsin's Midday News, making stories come to life. Now, here are your hosts, Jessica Tai, and in for Greg Matzik, it's Adam Roberts.
It is 10 minutes after 2 o'clock on this Christmas Eve. Should we track him? Should we track him, Adam?
I think we're going to track him, Jessica.
Where is Santa now? Let's, oh, I thought you were going to look. I can tell you it's Sudan.
Not a problem. Yes, he is over Sudan, right about the central part of the country, working his way west right now. But as we said earlier, his route can change at the drop of a Santa hat. So who knows where he could be next?
I see what you did there. It's been kind of interesting, too, because I like as we track through NORAD, by the way, who's been tracking Santa for 70 years now. Mm. It's been kind of interesting since we don't have any snow falling on this Christmas Eve and we won't have snow falling tomorrow. I was curious where Santa is during his travels, where it is snowing. And what was it, about an hour ago or so, he was in Romania, 34 degrees in light snow. So he was seeing some snow in Romania as he dropped off the kids.
But he's got to work in all kinds of conditions. I don't think they have a whole lot of snow in central Sudan right now, which just goes to show Santa is a jack of all trades, can work in any climate anywhere in the world.
And can I just clarify, Santa is not dropping off the kids. Santa is dropping off the presents for
yes.
the kids.
And also, interestingly, NORAD tracks how many he has dropped off
yes.
this year, more than 3.2 billion, well, I had Powerball on the mind, 3.2 billion gifts delivered so far across the world.
That's awesome. He will be headed here to Wisconsin in just a bit. We've got another big hour for you coming up. A convicted judge is not backing down. Milwaukee County Judge Hannah Dugan wants a new trial. So what happens next, and how hard is it to overturn a jury's verdict? We'll discuss with CBS Justice correspondent Scott McFarlane. And Christmas comes early in an unexpected place, the grocery store.
Here's your top two at two on Wisconsin's Midday News.
Number one, a developing story today. This one's new. ICE documents reveal the Trump administration plans to hold thousands of immigrants in warehouses. The plan is to build some of those warehouses from the ground up and renovate others. CBS's Michael Wallace has the details.
The administration is seeking contractors to renovate warehouses across the country into large-scale holding centers. The Washington Post reviewed a draft solicitation, which says the new facilities will minimize costs, shorten processing times, and speed up the deportation process. 7 large warehouses would each hold 5 to 10,000 people. 16 smaller warehouses would hold up to 1,500 detainees each.
The warehouses would hold people before they're deported. The Department of Homeland Security declined to answer questions about this warehouse plan.
Number two, a warning if you still have student loans out there. The Trump administration announcing that it will garnish wages of student loan borrowers that are in default.
The Department of Education says starting in January, notices will start going out to borrowers in default, which is defined as 270 days without making a payment. The process, called administrative wage garnishment, allows the department to order non-federal employers to withhold part of an employee's income for loan repayment. The Education Department says more than 5 million borrowers are in default and nearly 4 million are delinquent or haven't made a payment in more than 90 days. Linda Kenyon, CBS News, Washington.
Yeah, I'll definitely say, as someone who still has quite a bit of student loans still out from when I graduated about 10 years ago, it's been a whirlwind of how much do you owe now versus how much do you owe a couple of years ago when we had the pandemic and the SAVE plan was out there. In fact, on my student loan service provider, when you open the website up, there's this big giant banner that always pops up and always annoys me that says a reminder that the SAVE plan is now on hold. But oh yes, it's been on hold for like 2 years at this point. Thank you very much for that reminder. But a good reminder, as always, to stay on track of that. Even if you only pay the minimum, something is better than nothing.
Oh gosh, yeah, that definitely helps. Got to win that Powerball.
$1.7 billion, that'll take care of it.
A Christmas story coming up next.
It is a Christmas Eve Wednesday, and everyone's got their holiday traditions. We've talked about it quite a bit here on WTMJ walking up to the Christmas holiday. One of those traditions in some families is the reading of a Christmas story. And I'm not talking about the movie with Ralphie and shooting his eye out, but actual books and Christmas tales. Jessica, did you ever have a Christmas story your family read to you when you were growing up?
I don't really remember them sitting down and reading any particular Christmas tale in general, but when you ask me about books and Christmas, I think about the story that I had this big box. There was this big box under the tree. I don't remember how old I was. I was very curious. So I don't know. Say maybe I was eight or nine. Okay. I'm not sure. So there was this big box, and it was so big. I was like, what is in that? I wanted to know so bad what was in it. So one day after school, I don't know if I was home alone or what the deal was. So maybe I was older than eight. And I decided I was going to very gently unpeel the corners just so I could see a little bit of the box. Just wanted to see a little bit of it. And so I started to take it away. And then it was just, I couldn't tell what it was because it was just a cardboard box. So I did all this work and then I had to redo it, you know, tape it back up and make it look real nice. And guess what it really was? At the end of the day, after all of that, after I tried to see early what it was the series of Encyclopedia Britannicas. And as a
that's a classic.
Listen, it's a great resource. And we don't really have anything like that because everybody just goes to the internet these days. So I truly appreciate it. But at the time, as a kid, I didn't want encyclopedias. My mom was not reading them to me, though, by the way.
Okay. Well, I remember, so we most people are familiar with the Polar Express movie with the animated kids whose eyes don't really move enough for animated eyes, etc. But I was read the actual book, the Polar Express book. And one of the things I remember about it was it came in a really special package because, spoiler alert, there is a Santa jingle bell that is an important part of that story. And the book package came with its own jingle bell for you to read, like an old school bell that would be on Santa's sleigh. So I always remember it was in a felt package and it had a plastic top you would take off. So I just remember that story that my parents read to me, or I could just read on my own time because also, spoiler alert, young Adam was a big fan of trains and that stuck around for several years. Well, in the theme of Christmas stories, every year our local paper, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, publishes a Christmas story, specifically their executive editor, Greg Borowski. He's been doing this for several years. This isn't just him at the paper in Milwaukee. He even did this at his last job in Lansing, Michigan.
Since 1996.
So next year, I believe this is 30 total years now if you do the math, 96 to 2025. So I had Borowski in for Reporter's Notebook this week, and I had to ask how this all got started back in the mid-90s. And, oh, of course, Ross Perot.
I was trying to write a Christmas note to folks, and it just finished, you know, the presidential election year, which was a big to-do for us. It was one of the Ross Perot years, so I decided to write a story that was just more of a send-up of the election, kind of a humorous offbeat thing in which Ross Perot was an elf who was trying to, you know, reform Christmas and that things weren't working properly and all that sort of thing.
I will credit Greg with this. He did not do the whole when someone was a generation before you and is speaking to you about something from the past going, you young ones may not remember Ross Perot. Like, he give me the benefit of the doubt there. I do know, yes, who Ross Perot
is. Can't you picture, though, Ross Perot as an elf?
A little bit.
I can picture it when he said that.
So that started this now 30-year tradition where Greg writes a story. And the story, as was published a few days ago in the paper, it's called The Santa Trap, A Story of Christmas. And I won't spoil it. I did read the full story. But what I will say is the story includes something I was curious about. What makes a story, it doesn't have to be Christmas, but what makes it rereadable? Because you can pick up any book you want, read it through once, and put it on the shelf and then not think about it for 5 years. But a special story is one, especially around the holidays, that you want to come back to. And here's what Greg shared with me.
Every time I'm writing a story, I try to avoid setting it in a specific year or even, I mean, you'll see very few in my stories. I think I have one reference maybe over the years to someone, you know, having what would be a cell phone with them. Everything else is just, you know, things that could have happened in an every when kind of situation.
And again, without spoiling the Santa Trap story for this year, I will say that that is prevalent in this. This could be 1971. It could be 2024. And that's just left to your imagination to figure out.
I love that. When you talk about rereading books, I mean, especially depending on what book it is and as an adult, I mean, that takes a real commitment to say, I liked this book so much, I'm going to go back and read it.
So if you want to hear more of our conversation I had with Greg Borowski, the executive editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, on his Christmas stories, that's coming up on Reporter's Notebook this Sunday at 10 a.m. right here on WTMJ.
Okay, Adam, breaking news here. I just got a text, and I was looking to see what it is, and it's my mother. She's listening. She says, don't you remember your dad and I would always read The Night Before Christmas in your yellow bedroom?
Aw, that's so sweet.
I'm so sorry, Mom. I don't remember. I guess I was too young. She says, I always remember because one night you couldn't go to sleep and we went to check on you and you said it was so hard to sleep with sugar plums dancing in your head.
That makes sense, though. You know, we have a theme going on right now. Your mom's texting you during the show.
That's
my
right.
mom
is
also texting
you
me because we've been talking about the Powerball drawing tonight. $1.7 billion, by the way. And I got this one about a half hour ago. I just bought 5 Powerball tickets. If I win, I will share it with you. And everyone here should take note. And your coworkers.
What?
And that's in writing. So, Mom, you kind of just signed yourself up for something, and it's I'm going to hold you to it if you get the big win tonight.
Thank you, Mom Roberts.
Thank you, Mama Bergie.
How about that? Thinking about us.
All right.
Okay. I like that. All right. Well, good luck if you're playing. And I'm sorry, Mom, that I do not remember that. I have a lot of great memories, though. Just not that one. I must have been too young. Apparently, though, I had sugar plums dancing in my head.
Which is so excited. Hard to sleep when that's happening, as everyone knows.
Christmas comes early for customers at a supermarket in Texas. ABC's Jim Ryan says it all started with a computer glitch.
When the cash registers went dark and the checkout line grew, the manager made an announcement.
Unfortunately, the computers are not coming back up right now.
Customers knew it couldn't be good, and then it was.
Everything that you have, we are going to back you up, and we hope every one of you have a very Merry Christmas.
Melinda Brown is on a fixed income and couldn't believe it.
I had probably about 4 or 5 bags full of stuff because I've got grandkids coming.
Jim Ryan, ABC News, Dallas.
How lovely is that?
That's incredible. I know we're all trying as we have our plans for this week, getting everything ready. We've had stories in the news about the stress, and I don't think there's any more than comes with it than prepping the meal sometimes. So this is just an act of good that's going to have a big, 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 big impact.
Well, and you could see some stores where you have a computer glitch like this, everything goes dark, and you're like, okay, everybody, we're so sorry for the inconvenience. It's going to take us 10 minutes. It's going to take us this, or we're so sorry, we can't do anything about this. But these people are like, you know what? We can't do anything about it. We're going to bag this up. You can take those groceries home. And if you think about, I mean, when you get your receipts at the grocery store these days and you look to see the prices of things, I mean, it adds up. So that's great. I wonder if there were some people who were like, bag it up, grab another bag, stuff it in.
I think that's human nature. Yep, you hear, oh, free? It's free? All right, and don't mind if I do. I do wonder, the skeptic in me is, and this, they don't name the supermarket in the story, but I'm hopeful that management isn't going to pull that whole, well, I know the employees did this, but we are going to have to come around and that's going to come out of the bottom line. Like, just settle down. We don't need to ruin the story like that. Just let's make this be a good story. Please.
I feel like you needed to make, if the manager wasn't there, I feel like you needed to make a call to the manager before you made that call.
That is a very good point. Clear it with the person upstairs before you do that. That's a good point.
By the way, if there was somebody, one or two people doing that, you know, stuff something more in the bag, it kind of, that visual gave me a visual of supermarket sweep. Did you ever see that show? Or
I don't think so.
That wasn't, it must have been before your time. It was so fun because it was this game show basically inside the supermarket. And you'd be running down the aisles to get what you need or to get as much as you could. It was just kind of fun.
I feel like I saw that once during the pandemic when the toilet paper rush was on at the Festival Foods in La Crosse.
I always remember Festival Foods. Oh, yeah? Those days in La Crosse, working
Festival
in La Crosse.
Festival Foods. Let it snow.
It's time to chat with one of the hardest working correspondents at CBS News. I can't imagine anyone else at the network has the depth of R&B knowledge like he does, right? Nobody.
Not a chance.
No way.
It's not even close, Justin Adams. Not even close.
It is CBS Justice correspondent Scott McFarland. Merry Christmas Eve, Scott.
Right back at you, to you and Adam, and of course in Greg's absence, and Gina, and I think you've done justice by the holiday playing Boys to Men.
There you go. Boys to Men, ABC, BBD. I did kind of laugh, though, because we only got one line. I was waiting for another line, but you didn't need it.
In due time.
All right, Scott. Well, Milwaukee County Judge Hannah Dugan is not backing down after last week's split jury verdict. Her attorneys just announced that she's going to seek a new trial. They're also expected to ask the judge to set aside the verdict entirely. Dugan was found guilty of obstructing federal agents looking to make an immigration arrest outside of her courtroom. How high is the bar to overturn a jury's guilty verdict?
Exceptionally high, and this is exactly what nearly all federal criminal defendants do. If they're convicted by a jury, they will mechanize and officially notice their appeal is coming, then file that appeal with the circuit court, and then go through the process, a process that can devour many months and for many criminal defendants can devour many hundreds of thousands of dollars. But for the judge, I mean, she's off the bench and the penalty, I suppose, has already been put into effect for her. This is a federal felony she was convicted of. This is a process that she'll go through that will take time. But I got to tell you, in the meantime, it's a big victory for the Trump administration. They made this a poster child case. I mean, they literally posted that photo, you can all recall it, of Judge Dugan being perp walked out of the courthouse, handcuffed. And to secure a jury victory is no small thing for them because they've been hitting a rough patch with other prosecutions of other public figures. They couldn't muster the prosecution of James Comey, got dismissed. Couldn't get Tish James, the New York Attorney General, prosecuted. Case dismissed and then grand juries rejected. This is a win among many losses.
It's interesting, though, as you say that, Scott, because while I would agree with you, it is a victory in the short term for the Trump administration. We'll see where this possibility of overturning the ruling with the judge goes. It's not like I've seen, whether it's Kash Patel or Pam Bondi or Trump himself, trumpeting their victory a lot about this, whether on social media or in any sort of media gaggles at all, apart from the day of the verdict. It's not like they've been making this a daily reminder for people, though. Does that intrigue you at all?
Yeah, they'd gone quiet for a while. You're absolutely right about that, Adam. But there was a social media post from the Department of Justice, you know, saying no one's above the law in the hours after Judge Dugan was convicted. Listen, the problem that I see from my vantage point is that it's unclear to people involved, and it's unclear to those of us who cover the Department of Justice, whether all these cases are expected to actually go to trial, or is the process the reason for some of these investigations? You know, they ran James Comey through a ringer. They made him walk into a courthouse, have his mugshot taken, be processed by U.S. Marshals, pay for a lawyer, have the headlines about him. That case is dismissed, but the pain's already been inflicted. And I haven't talked to any legal analyst who thought that thing was ever going to lead to a conviction. And Scott, I don't think the Trump administration's under a different idea.
Scott, there's no sentencing date yet. Instead, we have a briefing scheduled. What does that tell you about how seriously the court is weighing these challenges?
It's not frequent. It's not common to get past a jury trial, get to verdict, and not have a sentencing date set. So this is not ordinary. And maybe there's a different vantage point from the court, anticipating appeal, preparing for appeal. But usually when we sit there and we watch a defendant get convicted, they announce the sentencing date right then, right there. It gets delayed and it shifts around, but they said it. But they haven't set Judge Dugan's is different. It's a different posture. It doesn't mean anything's going to be more or less likely for her in the appeals process.
Were you surprised by the split verdict?
Yeah, I would say it's always surprising when a jury comes back with a split verdict and they go not guilty on a misdemeanor and guilty on a felony. But let me tell you, I did jury duty. And for anybody else listening who's done jury duty, you understand what I'm about to say. You never can get 12 people to agree on a damn thing. It's just hard. Yeah. It's hard to get 12
Very
people
true.
To agree the sky is blue. Everybody brings their own personal vantage points, their own life experience, their own education, their own sense of a case. And when we had a split verdict on my jury, we actually understood at the end of the day that was what we needed to do. The judge was so surprised, he came back to talk to us, asked us what we were thinking.
Really?
So I'm never totally surprised by a jury doing anything because it's so difficult to get 12 people to agree on anything. But it's uniquely uncommon for there to be a guilty on the felony and not guilty on the misdemeanor. I'll grant you that.
Well, the defense is pointing to jury instructions as a key issue. Jury instructions matter. What could have gone wrong here?
Well, you had a defense that presented a case but didn't present a witness, a defendant on the stand. That's common. A lot of criminal cases go that way, but sometimes juries are unsatisfied with that. Sometimes juries don't care. This jury may have had a point of view. It's a high-profile case. I mean, they did, one would think, an admirable job in jury selection to ensure there were no biases, but it's hard to imagine nobody'd heard of this case. When they get into the room, that can impact deliberations. I mean, I did the trial a few weeks ago. The man who threw the sandwich at the federal agent, you know, sandwich guy,
yes,
who was put on trial in Washington, D.C. I talked to the jurors. The jurors were like, yeah, we heard of the case. We couldn't believe when we got picked for the jury for the case. So they didn't go in there as a blank slate, even though they went in there with open ears and open minds. They had some backstory on the case. And who knows if that sways a jury one way or the other.
A big story today, two police officers who defended the U.S. Capitol during the January 6 attacks in 2021 are hoping for a Christmas gift, the plaque created in their honor hung up at the Capitol. Years later, well past the deadline, it is still not up, and now the officers are making moves in federal court to make it happen. Can you detail the new development here?
Yeah, we're 5 years next month from the January 6th insurrection. Where did those 5 years go? And in 2022, in the aftermath of the violent riot at the Capitol that nearly overturned our democracy, there was a law passed, signed by the president, passed by Congress, requiring a plaque be hung on the west front of the Capitol, site of the most violent rioting, to honor the police heroes who saved democracy and saved the Capitol. The deadline to hang it was 2023. 2023 came and went, no plaque. 2024 has come and gone, no plaque. 2025 is about to enter and exit with no plaque. And after all the political lobbying, the police heroes are now suing, saying that the architect of the Capitol, the congressional leadership, Republicans in this case, are violating the law. See if the judge wants to intervene and make an order. The plaque's been made. It's just sitting on the floor in some storage room at the Capitol. But you can see the subtext here, right? The president claims January 6th is a hoax or was a political weaponization. His surrogates control Congress, and they don't speak of January 6th. They don't commemorate it. They don't talk about it. They don't answer questions about it. They don't acknowledge it. They don't claim it to be a hoax, but they are not about to put up a plaque. And let me tell you, it's a small thing, but it's a big thing. And it's a wedge issue. And it really has led to increased toxicity in an already toxic Washington.
Speaking of deadlines, Scott, the can continues, it seems, to be kicked on getting all of the files related to Jeffrey Epstein out. The Justice Department just today saying it's going to need at least a few more weeks. It has a million more documents that they have to sift through. I keep finding myself coming back to, though, like, there was a bill passed by President Trump, agreed to by both bodies of Congress, that it had to be on the day that it was, that deadline of last Friday. Can they just theoretically keep kicking this can as long as they want to?
There'll be a legal challenge. Democrats in Congress will file a legal challenge saying the law is not being followed. I don't see how they execute that legal challenge through the Justice Department against the Justice Department. Let's put that aside. Let's put the legalities aside. There's two big issues here, Adam. First of all, the survivors are, in some cases, outraged by this. It's hard. They are waiting for their files, their information to get released. They don't know when it's going to happen. They advocated for a law, got it passed, and it's not being followed. They're angry, frustrated, and to a degree, surprised by how this has gone. Second issue is the political one. I mean, this just draws out the pain for the Trump administration, because they keep getting accused of being cover-up artists or people who are dragging their heels deliberately. And whether they are or not, this gives that appearance, and they have now extended this news cycle for weeks to come, and they don't like talking about this. The president gets angry when he's asked about it, and his surrogates, his Republican surrogates in Washington, they aren't out there the last few days defending the administration's performance on these files. This is going to be a chronic problem now for the administration.
I saw one of the survivors, Maria Farmer, issued a statement to you last night. How is this release going over with her?
She feels vindicated because some of the files released show she was telling the truth, and she was prophetic back in 1996 when she warned about Epstein.
Yeah.
But she's also sick of getting up in the morning not knowing if files have been released when she went to bed. And I think she speaks for a larger group of people, and this is not the way they wanted to see this go.
Do you think that there's going to be another mass release of Epstein files soon? I feel like the holidays are kind of like the Friday news dump. People think maybe we put this out late Friday, maybe we put it out around the holidays and nobody will end up seeing it.
Even if you don't give a sinister motivation to it of trying to bury it, they're under pressure to do it fast. And I think they'd rather, and people would rather it get done in the next few days versus waiting till the holidays are over. I would be surprised if we get back Monday and more hasn't been released.
Yeah. CBS Justice correspondent Scott McFarland, thank you so much. And Merry Christmas to you and your family, Scott.
Same to you. And is it Jordan Love Sunday or what? Do we know yet?
Well, he's still in concussion protocol, Scott. We've got Malik also out because apparently he has an illness today. So it could be Clayton Tune season. It may be tuning up the band, although
I feel like it's going to be Love.
Yeah,
I'm thinking it's going to be Love, but we don't know for sure. We don't know for sure, Scott.
Merry Christmas to you all. You are great to work with.
Merry Christmas, you too.
I'll be home for Christmas.
All right, this is it. Our last batch of year-in-review stories today throughout the show. We've been picking out of our grab bag here. Categories include weather, sports, politics, entertainment, and health. Now in our third hour, only a few left. I don't know if we're going to get to all of them, though. Adam, let's do it. Make the pick.
What's up next? Get right in here. Get that hand in. All right, we're going White House.
I thought people are either going to love this one or they're going to hate it. I don't know if there was a day a story wasn't coming out of the White House, but here's a review of the top stories from the White House this year.
On day one, President Trump granted clemency to the January 6 rioters. Hundreds had assaulted police. Later, he deployed National Guard troops, calling it a crackdown on crime. The president's core domestic policy was a tax and spending bill.
One great, big, beautiful bill.
Trump tried to end Russia's war against Ukraine. Frustrated, he threw Ukrainian President Zelensky out of the White House.
You don't have the cards.
The president sought the Nobel Peace Prize.
I solved 8 wars.
Including the war in Gaza, but not Ukraine.
This should be easier.
Trump imposed global tariffs.
Tariff is my favorite word.
The Supreme Court is deciding if the tariffs are legal. Dogging the president throughout the year, the case of convicted sex offender and former friend Jeffrey Epstein.
Are people still talking about this guy, this creep?
Eventually saying he supported release of the Epstein files. President Trump unveiled a pet project.
Probably the finest ballroom ever built.
Saying it would not affect the White House.
Near it, but not touching it.
Later demolishing the entire East Wing. Linda Kenyon, CBS News.
I'm not going to lie, I feel it's kind of ironic that I let you do the picking. And the first one you picked, Adam? Deaths.
You keep coming back to that. I told you it wasn't my fault.
In the last one, the White House.
Man, I'm just a terrible picker.
We had entertainment, we had economy, talking about money, we had health. What else did we not get around to? Oh, no, we did get most of them. I just think it's funny. I think it's funny. The first one you picked, all the people who passed away this year.
Yeah, I mean, it was sad. I will not begrudge you that. By the way, coming up right after the top of the hour news, I'll be sticking around for a little bit. It is the official WTMJ Year in Review. Put this together every year. We'll be running that today, so sit tight. We're going to look back at the year that was straight ahead.
Thank you so much for joining us today and all year here on Wisconsin's Midday News. Merry Christmas, everybody, and Happy New Year.